I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Schools like the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University, both in Minnesota, are sending email alerts to students studying abroad, telling them to stay in touch with their program directors. Tourists so far aren't canceling plans, but after yesterday's terror alert warning of potential threats in Europe, they have a lot of questions. Here are some travelers at Des Moines Airport.
I was a little puzzled because I haven't heard of this before. It's rare that it's Europe. It's usually other parts of the world.
It's kind of a case of we're not going to let terrorists reign our lives and control it.
I've never traveled overseas, but even domestically, I think that we have a responsibility to be aware of our surroundings and be careful when we're flying.
Well, yesterday's alert was one step short of a travel warning, which would have advised against travel. It's aimed at informing rather than alarming, and it comes after a critical mass of evidence built up over the last few months pointing to terrorist plans to target European countries with Mumbai-style attacks using assault weapons in public places. Scott Shane is national security correspondent for The New York Times. And Scott, you quote a student who said to her parents, "Why did you Skype me this alert? I'm in London. I have to take the tube." And terrorism expert Bruce Hoffman said he wished it was more direct.
I think the frustration is the vagueness of this travel alert. Usually these things are aimed at a particular country. In this case, it's an entire continent, the whole continent of Europe. And in addition, what people are being told is that the terrorists have often in the past attacked public transportation and what it calls tourist infrastructure. Well, we sort of know that. It's hard to act on. I mean, you know, if I'm in London, do I take the tube or not? If I'm in Paris, do I go to the Louvre or the Art Museum or not? It's very hard to act on such vague advice.
And you quote other people, including a former Bush administration Homeland Security official, who say, absolutely, the president was right. Something had to be said.
Yes, I think if you look at this from the government standpoint, they do not want to be accused of hiding information that they have about a credible threat from the public. There's sort of a policy that if they believe there's a real threat, they'll share it with the American public. The other point that some counterterrorism experts make is that in recent times, there have been quite a few cases of ordinary citizens intervening to stop or interfere with terrorist attacks. For example, in May, when Faisal Shahzad left that smoking SUV on Times Square, It was actually a vendor who alerted the police to it. It wasn't, you know, our many security forces. It was just a regular street vendor. And back on Christmas Day, when the Nigerian man, Abdu Muttalib, tried to set off a bomb on an airliner bound for Detroit, it was another passenger who tackled him and tried to put out the flames. So, you know, some counterterrorism folks say that if people are a little bit more wary, a little bit more alert than they would normally be, the chances of actually interfering with and stopping an attack might be greater.
We'll just talk briefly about European reaction. These alerts and the information that's been gathered in the last few weeks has renewed the debate over whether to equip Scotland Yard with battlefield-style automatic weapons. They right now, you know, don't have that kind of a high-powered weapon. And yet countries across Europe have had a different reaction as far as raising their own alert status. So just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, all of the three countries that appear to be most at highest risk, according to these sketchy intelligence reports, which would be the UK, France, and Germany, they all put out statements essentially offering support for the action the U.S. had taken. As you note, the British and indeed other countries are talking about, are they ready for a Mumbai-style attack? As people will recall, that was a group of sort of commandos attacking with automatic weapons and grenades in multiple locations at once, a very different scenario from the sort of lone suicide bomber.
Scott, if I can ask you just one last thing briefly, U.S. intelligence officials seem to believe Osama bin Laden may be behind these plans. What would that mean to you?
Osama bin Laden has been obviously in hiding for many years. Certainly, if he were tied to a major plot in Europe or the United States, I think it would refocus the now, you know, more than decade-old American attempt to find him and capture or kill him.
Scott Shane, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Scott, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are we back where we once were on racially segregated schools? A recent report found that in cities like Chicago, Illinois, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Syracuse in upstate New York, black students go to almost entirely black schools. And conversely, the average white student in Chicago goes to a school that's almost entirely white. Researchers from Northeastern University studied the 100 largest metropolitan areas. Their litmus, how much do schools reflect the towns they're in? So, say in Texas, schools are largely Hispanic, but so are the cities they're in. Whereas in Springfield, Massachusetts, Hispanic students are corralled in schools separate from other populations in town. So Springfield got a very high segregation ranking. One of the researchers concludes that overall, American students attend schools that are largely separate and unequal. Let's take a deeper look today with Professor Dolores Acevedo Garcia. She's one of the authors of the report and is Associate Director of the Institute on Urban Health Research at Northeastern University. And Professor, you know, I can hear people saying, well, of course schools are segregated. Because let's face it, people are segregated today, maybe even self-segregated, choosing to live with their own. You looked at residential segregation. What did you find?
Yeah, we conclude that the very high levels of school segregation that we documented in this report are related to residential segregation for sure. So we isolate ourselves in very segregated communities. And in our country, to a large extent, kids go to neighborhood-based schools. So housing segregation leads to school segregation. There is a very strong relationship there. But in addition to that, the way in which school districts assign students also plays a large role.
Well, and you say as far as residential segregation, schools and towns need to use tools to attack that, like enforcing fair housing. Sometimes this residential segregation is because people can't afford to move to other towns. So you say build affordable housing, but also use policies like the Promise Neighborhood Initiative. What's that?
The idea there is focusing around a school that tends to be a charter school to try to improve the neighborhood and the school.
And in some ways, perhaps if you, you know, focus on a school, really boost the school, make it a great school, you might even attract students from outside the blighted area to come to that school. And in Boston, there's Boston Latin, and there are white parents that vie to get their kids into that school.
Absolutely.
But right now that's rare. Right now students are segregated, as you found, blacks in black schools, Hispanics and with Hispanics, whites with whites, largely. And you found that overall, this was happening in areas in the Northeast and Midwest. They had the most segregated schools, and that's because it's towns that oversee the schools, not counties. What do you mean by that?
Well, one very important variable in the Northeast that creates more segregation is that we have a lot of municipalities. Our metropolitan areas are very fragmented. There are many municipalities in a given area. That way, you know, we are able to isolate ourselves even more so than if we had larger units of government that control the school districts.
Yeah. Well, and another huge surprise came with the Hispanic segregation ranking. Springfield, Massachusetts, number 2, 4 New England cities, Hartford, Providence, Rhode Island, Boston, and Springfield, in the top 10 of the most segregated Hispanic schools. Some would think that would be something you'd find in California or in the Southwest. Now, Los Angeles was number 1.
Yes, we did find that the highest levels of Hispanic segregation in schools were in the Northeast and also the Midwest. I've had people tell me, well, that's very shocking. I didn't even know that we had a Latino population in Boston, which is very telling of how isolated we are, that people don't even realize that we do have a Hispanic population in the Boston area.
Because they're segregated.
Exactly. It's not only the high levels of segregation of Hispanic students, though. It's also the high exposure to poverty in schools that they are facing. So these two issues run together.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the other factors here. A lot of people, you know, maybe who don't have kids in school aren't aware of the role of school assignments. We understand in the past decade, the number of school districts using not just race, but broader socioeconomic factors like income to assign students to schools has grown from just about a few to about 80. So more are doing this. But also at the same time, we understand a lot of schools are confused about how much they can use race in school assignment because of recent court decisions. Louisville, Kentucky, for instance, is thinking of going back to community schools because they had a socioeconomic diversity plan, but the Supreme Court overturned the city's race-based school assignment plan. So now everybody's up in the air. What are we allowed to do?
the decision was that the schools could not use race at the individual level of the student as a factor in assignment. The part of the decision that is often overlooked is that the court still felt that it's very compelling for us as a society to try to promote racial and ethnic diversity. So there are other mechanisms that school districts are trying to promote integration. Some of them have to do with using socioeconomic status instead of race. And they are also trying to implement other solutions, such as focusing, for example, on the neighborhood where the students are coming from. So that way they can overcome this limitation of not being able to use the race of the student in the assignment plans.
Well, Professor, this gets us into another sticky area. As you say, people are trying to figure out what they can or cannot do, and if they can't use race, they're maybe looking at socioeconomic. But either way, it means moving kids around, and a lot of parents don't want that. Wake County, North Carolina, dropped its socioeconomic diversity school assignment plan. It took family income into consideration and bused students to different neighborhoods, and in that area, it meant busing white kids of a higher income into a lower income area with more black kids, and those parents just did not want that. The NAACP is suing over this, but you run into that. There are parents who might even be sympathetic. They want more diversity, but they don't want their kid to go to a lesser school to achieve it.
Yeah, that is a problem. And the case that you mentioned in North Carolina is an important one. We are very accustomed to thinking that we can isolate ourselves into areas or municipalities, school districts in which we can shield our kids from being exposed to students that are not performing well, students that have lower achievement, high poverty. And I think that part of the challenge right now that we are trying to promote with this report is to think about ourselves as a region. We have a responsibility for the children in the Boston schools, even if we live in the suburbs.
Well, so you live in Newton, which is a very wealthy suburb of Boston, and it just built one of the most expensive high schools in the world. Would you send your kids into a lower income neighborhood in Boston as opposed to, you know, letting them go to the beautiful new high school right down the street from you?
I think under a number of different circumstances, I may. First of all, if we had identified a magnet school, for example, in Boston that catered to some of the interests of my children, for example, one of them has artistic inclinations, I would definitely consider that.
Magnet schools, again, they might focus on, well, the arts, as you just said, and the ideas that they might attract, like a magnet, kids from around the region.
Right. I think that our suburbs should be doing more to try to integrate kids that are coming from, for example, Boston Public Schools. So it runs both ways.
That's Professor Dolores Acevedo-Garcia of Northeastern University on a new report that found American schools largely segregated. By the way, on Friday, school officials here in Boston agreed to overhaul programs for limited English students after a federal investigation found the schools were failing them. It's going to cost the city a lot of money. More from Professor Garcia when we come back here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking about a recent report that shows how segregated many metropolitan area schools are in the U.S. In Chicago on Saturday, Education Secretary Arne Duncan told a meeting of the American Bar Association that if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. were alive today, he'd be disheartened to see so many schools still effectively segregated. Secretary Duncan pointed out that at Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas, where 9 black students were integrated by force into the all-white school in 1957, the student population is now almost entirely black. He also noted that Central High does draw some white students from the suburbs, but he said in far too many minority communities, the schools simply aren't good enough. Well, Dolores Acevedo-Garcia is Associate Director of the Institute on Urban Health Research at Northeastern University, co-author of this report that found high levels of school segregation. And Professor, there are voluntary programs in some school districts, such as the METCO program here in Boston, where inner city kids are bused out to the suburbs. But critics say there's too long a waiting line to get into the program. And also, if everyone is able to do that, you'd leave shells of schools behind in the cities. We just heard about Boston failing some of its inner city kids. But you were also just saying, reverse the thinking, strengthen the urban schools so that they can draw kids in from the suburbs.
Our report speaks about mobility, both in terms of mobility that has to do with neighborhoods and mobility that has to do with schools. And that's a very important conclusion. However, we are not saying in any way that interventions that try to address very disadvantaged neighborhoods or very disadvantaged schools are not important. They are critically important. But there is a limit to what districts can do because of the really high levels of segregation and poverty concentration that we have within urban districts. For example, Boston Public Schools are about 75% minority, 75% poor students. Even with better school assignment plans in Boston, the levels of segregation are high in the city. So without the possibility of inter-district mobility, we can only do so much to improve isolation by race or by income within the limits of the city.
Well, is there a school system that is doing school assignment plans that you could point to as working?
Seattle, San Francisco, Berkeley, Omaha, St. Louis, Missouri.
Why? What do they do?
They are doing different things. Some programs are focusing on socioeconomic variables instead of race explicitly. Some of them are using neighborhood-based variables, so solutions that try to avoid using race explicitly but trying to achieve the same outcomes.
So those are moves to desegregate schools. But after a Boston Globe story on your research, which again showed how much segregation there is in the U.S. and called for bringing more inner-city kids out to the suburbs and also building up inner-city schools to draw kids from the suburbs into the cities, after a story, there was very angry reaction online. Your response to that?
One of the things that I found fascinating and also disturbing about having issued the report is the responses that we received. We received a lot of encouraging responses, people saying, I'm glad you are pointing this out. I know the segregation is still an issue. I'm very happy to discuss solutions. But there are also a lot of really angry responses that we had to the report, such as, if those parents valued education for their children, they would just choose to move to the suburbs and they would send their kids to those schools. Because the issue is, if you share those values, then you can move and your kids can go to that school.
And you're saying that there isn't enough affordable housing.
Yeah, people avoiding areas because they don't feel welcome is another factor. We do not fully understand the contribution of each of these factors to the very high levels of residential segregation that we have. However, we analyzed the 2000 census data a couple of years ago, and we were trying to see what is the proportion of kids in our metro areas that live in a poor family and also live in a poor neighborhood. We found that across the 100 largest metro areas, about 17% of Black kids live in a poor family and also in a poor neighborhood. And about 21% of Hispanic kids live in a poor family and also in a poor neighborhood. Only 1% of white kids, it's actually 1.4% of white kids live in a poor family and also in a poor neighborhood.
Meaning that poor white families were more easily accepted into mixed income neighborhoods.
Yes. Poor white families can more easily buy into neighborhoods that are not poor, much more so than minorities, because we are talking about a disparity of about 20 times higher a proportion of Black and Latino kids that live in both a poor family and a poor neighborhood.
You know, this seems like such an odd thing to be happening when I'm thinking that young people in this country have never been more integrated as far as popular culture, the music they listen to, and yet we see that in so many cities it's as bad in being separated from each other as it was in the 50s.
It is as bad, and we mentioned some data in our report that actually school segregation has increased, for example, between 1988 and today. And it, as you said, it's very shocking that it's happening. We know that about 44% of our child population is of minority background. We say in the report of our public school population at the elementary school level, about 55% is comprised of children of minority background. So we are clearly going to be a society in which we are going to have to know how to deal with each other. And we are limiting contact, you know, between groups at this very early age, which is exactly the age in which kids would be learning the critical skills of dealing with different ideas, different ethnic backgrounds, different cultural backgrounds. It was a really bad thing to have in the 50s and 60s. But I would say it's even worse now, given that as a society, we are going to be increasingly diverse.
Professor Dolores Acevedo Garcia, one of the authors of a recent report about segregation and poverty in America's 100 largest metro areas. She's associate director of the Institute on Urban Health Research at Northeastern University, which issued the report. Professor, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And we'd love to hear from you on this or any story. Just go to hereandnow.org, click on Contact Us, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there. Back with the latest news, Here and Now. Former White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel is wasting no time. He left Washington on Friday and today shook hands with commuters on an L train stop near Chicago's South Side, visited the city's Chatham and Pilsen neighborhoods, and even though he hasn't formally announced a run for mayor, he released a campaign strategy online.
I'm going to spend the next few weeks visiting our neighborhoods at grocery stores, L stops, bowling alleys, and hot dog stands. I'm calling this the Tell It Like It Is tour because I want to hear from you. In blunt Chicago terms, what you think about our city and how the next mayor and you can make it better.
Ray Long covers politics for the Chicago Tribune. Ray, we have to comment on the tone there. So low-key, what happened to the scrappy, expletive-deleted firebrand?
Well, I think there may be an effort there to try to make it seem that there are two Rahms, maybe the scrappy one and also the one who can be soft-sided and more even-keeled.
Well, his opponents aren't exactly welcoming him home with open arms. They've called him a carpetbagger. They've printed buttons with anyone but Rahm printed on them. But that's, you know, the jockeying for position in the mayoral race. He's had successful runs in the past. What do you think the people of Chicago think about this return? What do you think he's hearing?
Well, he's hearing a lot of things, and among them are, you know, come prove to us that you're a guy who can understand each part of Chicago, each different neighborhood. And the reason that's important, Robin, is because you're going to need to build a coalition here. This is a city with all kinds of hues of different people of color. And in fact, what we have here is a chance for a mayor to show that he can reach out to all different ones. And the current mayor, Richard M. Daley, has been able to do that. And if Rahm Emanuel can show that he is indeed the next person who can build a coalition, then he'll have a better shot at the job.
Well, some of the people he might run against, you know, that are also expected to run, you've got Cook County Sheriff Tom Dart, Alderman Robert Fioretti, Congressman Luis Gutierrez. He has huge support in the Latino community, and State Senator James Meeks, who runs a megachurch and has the backing of the African-American community. And we're hearing that some people are going to hold Rahm Emanuel's close ties to Barack Obama against him, you know, attacking maybe the stimulus. But in the African-American community, we're also hearing quotes from people saying, hey, if the president sent him here and thinks he's the guy, then I'm with him.
Right. It's very much a split, and you'll see the split along the lines of where people are jockeying for positions, too. But, you know, this is Chicago versus D.C., and the folks in Chicago don't want D.C. dictating to Chicago what they should be doing. So it was interesting that Obama said all these flattering things about Rahm, but the other thing that you have to keep in the back of your mind is that he is not just going to walk into this. He has to come out here and prove himself and show the people that he's really sincere about representing them and wants to be somebody who will take their issues up and fight for them.
Well, there's also questions of Rahm Emanuel's ties to Rod Blagojevich, the former governor, as he tried to find somebody to replace the president in the Senate seat. But putting those aside, there are other questions as to whether or not Rahm Emanuel has residency. He apparently tried to kick a tenant out of the apartment he was renting so he could have it back. The tenant refused to go. Are those real questions?
Well, the election law in Illinois is fairly sympathetic to the folks who are trying to get on the ballot. And in the past, there have been court rulings that say that a person can have many domiciles and only one actual residency. Rahm Emanuel has been voting from this address that he's rented out. There will be a lot of nuances, and of course, anybody who wants to run against Rahm Emanuel for the mayorship is going to have to find a way to beat him. If they can beat him in the courts, then they'll try to do that.
Oh, what fun for people like you. Ray Long covers politics for the Chicago Tribune, talking about the mayor's race there, which is going to be fun to watch and cover. Ray, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Quick look ahead tomorrow on Here and Now. A general who lost a son to combat, the other to suicide, joins us to talk about suicide prevention and why both deaths shouldn't be treated differently. They should be treated the same. That's tomorrow. Coming up, an astonishing discovery about secret U.S. medical experiments on Guatemalans in the late 1940s. That's in about 30 seconds. Here and Now. Well, we're going to start our next story with a warning. It is about sexually transmitted diseases, and the story may be inappropriate and uncomfortable for some listeners. Now, it's well known that U.S. health officials once used African-American sharecroppers as guinea pigs, observing them but not treating them as they suffered from syphilis. But in researching the Tuskegee experiments, Wellesley professor Susan Reverby made the astonishing discovery that from 1946 to 48, U.S. government scientists went further, deliberately and secretly infecting hundreds of Guatemalans with syphilis and gonorrhea as part of a public health study. Most of those infected were treated, but at least one died. They were prisoners, soldiers, mental health patients, men and women, who had probably no idea what was happening to them. And Susan Reverby joins us now. She's a professor of women's and gender studies at Wellesley College and author of the book Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. And Professor, I just want you to underscore what I just said. You know, part of the mythology of the Tuskegee experiments is that these sharecroppers were infected with this disease by U.S. officials. They were not. That's a myth. They were sick and were observed and not treated.
That's correct. And that's the difference between the two studies is really clear. In Tuskegee, the study was on latent syphilis. They were no longer contagious. In Guatemala, they gave people the disease.
Actually infected them.
Yes, they actually infected them by either sending in infected prostitutes, which was legal in Guatemala, into the prison for sexual services, or by actually taking an inoculum of the bacteria and putting it on the people's skins and on their mucous membranes.
Well, now, this is just really difficult to hear, but this is because you can't actually make a vaccine with syphilis and infect somebody with it?
No, you can't. You can't draw blood and just give it from the blood. It's the reason it's a sexually transmitted disease. The only way it can be transferred is through sexual contact from a mother who has the disease to her baby as it's being born and through breast milk.
So these Guatemalans were infected. They were, as we said, treated. Did Guatemalan officials know this?
Yes. A man named Juan Funes, who was the director of STD or of sexually transmitted diseases in the public health department in Guatemala, worked directly with them. And obviously, the United States can't just walk into a prison in Guatemala, so there had to be agreement with the head of a prison, the head of an insane asylum, and the head of an army barracks.
Well, you eventually took this information that you found all the way to the U.S. government. Over the weekend, both Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and President Obama apologized to Guatemalans. But back to the story as you found it in these dusty documents as it unfolded for you, you actually found a quote from the then U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Thomas Perrin, you know, consumed with controlling syphilis, which at the time was, you know, horrendous, fatal, you know, illness if not treated. And yet you find a quote from him saying that he realized the kind of study he was doing in Guatemala could never be conducted in the U.S. Now, that reveals he knew that what he was doing would not be allowed in the U.S. But you find that it actually, something like it had been done in the U.S., in Indiana?
Yes. Right. In Terre Haute, Indiana, in the penitentiary in the mid-40s, during the war there was, but not just on the arms, and they presumably got some kind of permission in the prison. It was very common to do prison research. And then in 1954, Cutler and others do the same research in Sing Sing, in upstate New York, in the prison, in the penitentiary in Sing Sing, in which they also give people syphilis and give them penicillin, but there they were just rubbing it on their arms. And it looks from the published report on that one that they did ask for permission of the prisoners.
We have to, I mean, again, this is very uncomfortable for some people, but we have to explain, when you say rub on their arms, again, you can infect somebody with, say, gonorrhea. The bacteria can come in through a vaccine with gonorrhea. With syphilis, it can't. And so there had to be an abrasion
somewhere. That's correct. That's correct. And they had to make an inoculum really fast. The reason it's sexually transmitted is it the bacteria that causes syphilis will die in the air.
So there's an abrasion made often on, you know, a male, you know, a penis.
Right.
And this is how this was done. This is horrific.
It is horrific. It is absolutely horrific. But remember, they thought at the time that syphilis was this terrible disease. Penicillin had just been discovered. They were trying to figure out whether penicillin could be used as what's called a prophylaxis, which means before you had the infection, you could keep it from growing in the body. So the plan was to give people this disease, but also to cure them.
Well, you were part of a group that lobbied President Bill Clinton to publicly apologize to the men who survived the Tuskegee study and their heirs. That was in 1997. As we said, President Obama has publicly apologized to the Guatemalan government. But what's in place that prevents this from happening again?
We have regulations now. We have the Declaration of Helsinki from the World Medical Association. We have, at least in the United States, we have institutional review boards. We have rules about informed consent. So this kind of thing could not happen. This would never get through a review board at this point. What we have to be concerned about, I think, is what gets done internationally and what kind of controls are continuing to be in place to make sure that this isn't being done. 80% of the drugs that come into the United States are tested outside the United States, and that's where I think the worry has to be.
And what will happen now? Again, a formal apology to Guatemalans. What more? I mean, couldn't they be asking for reparations?
I suspect, you know, this is above my pay grade, so I'm not a diplomat. They're going to have to figure this out. What the president has said is that the Institute of Medicine will do further research on who these people were and what happened, and I think that will go forward, and that his bioethics commission will look at this. And I think the Obama administration should be congratulated, frankly, for facing this up front and for responding immediately as opposed to pretending that this wasn't happening.
And just very briefly, Professor, who kept these documents?
The documents were given to the University of Pittsburgh archives, either by Dr. Cutler or his family, and I found them when I was doing research on my Tuskegee book. So they were not hidden. They were just sitting in an archive, and I was doing, you know, as I said, what historians do, which is go to archives and read dead people's mail. So that's what I was doing.
But you'd think that, you know, especially as the years went on, somebody would want to have them destroyed. Do you think that maybe somebody hoped that someone like you would stumble across them someday?
You know, it's a really interesting question. I mean, Cutler had a 50-year career. So when I went to the box, I expected to find stuff on Tuskegee, and all that was in it was the Guatemala material. So the question really is, and we'll never know the answer unless we can find a medium to talk to him from the dead, is why did he give the papers? Did he think he did a good thing or a bad thing?
That's Susan Reverby, professor of women's and gender studies at Wellesley College, Wellesley, Massachusetts, also author of Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy, and her new paper on the Guatemalan experiment. Guatemalans experimented on by U.S. Public health officials. That'll appear in the January 2011 issue of the Journal on Policy Journal of Policy History. Professor Reverby, thank you.
You're welcome.
Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. A quick musical news note. This is a nocturne from John Williams' Horn Concerto, performed by the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. It's a recording released in September, and maybe the last we hear from the symphony for a while. This morning in Detroit, symphony musicians hit the picket lines in their tuxedos, protesting a 33% pay cut proposed by beleaguered symphony management. The union offered to reduce their pay 22%, but a spokesperson said 33% just went too far. So one more setback for a struggling city. One wonders what Norman Rockwell might have done with the image of placard-carrying violinists. Norman Rockwell, of course, captured iconic moments of American culture. But less well-known is the influence he's had on Hollywood. Rockwell's work inspired everyone from Frank Capra to modern-day filmmakers like Steven Spielberg and George Lucas. And now a new exhibit at the Smithsonian American Art Museum in Washington, called Telling Stories, traces the connection between the great American painter and American movies. It shows how these great cinematic storytellers employ the same techniques that Rockwell used to distill experience into memory and transform that into myth. In fact, the Rockwell paintings in the exhibit come from the Lucas and Spielberg collections. The BBC's Jane O'Brien toured the exhibit and prepared this report.
Norman Rockwell has a unique place in American culture. Many critics think his illustrations of idealized life are too sentimental. Museums have often neglected them because they're not quite fine art. But Rockwell's paintings have endured a century because they epitomize the American dream.
They're all telling stories that take us a little bit away from where we are and put us into a place where we want to be, or we think we'd like to be. And they do it all in terms of ordinary people. Their people are people like us, people who we see on the street corner. They're our friends, our neighbors. So there's a remarkable connection between the stories that they tell, the things that we aspire to, and our own daily lives.
Virginia Mecklenburg is the curator of Telling Stories, an exhibition of Rockwell paintings taken from the private collections of the Hollywood directors Steven Spielberg and George Lucas.
The quintessential similarities between Norman Rockwell, George Lucas, and Steven Spielberg is that they're all storytellers, and they're all myth-makers. One of Rockwell's great accomplishments, I think, is the fact that he could tell a story in a single frame. And he worked very much the way a movie director does. He cast his pictures, he interviewed models, he selected all the props, so he was not only director, he was also art director, he was set manager, stage director. It's one of the things that George Lucas says when he talks about Rockwell's pictures. He said, everything there is absolutely part of the story. So George Lucas and Steven Spielberg both see wonderful cinematic possibilities and accomplishments that are part of Rockwell's paintings.
What put us into uniform, ready to engage the enemy on every continent and every ocean?
Rockwell's narrative genius and myth-making abilities became a potent force during the Second World War, when he joined with Hollywood to become part of the propaganda machine.
Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety.
In 1941, President Roosevelt invoked the Four Freedoms in a speech to persuade Americans to fight.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way.
But Rockwell knew it would take more than abstract ideals to convince people to make the sacrifices that lay ahead.
The fourth is freedom from fear.
In response to Roosevelt's Four Freedoms, he created some of his most famous works.
Freedom of speech, a man standing up in a town meeting, freedom from want, a grandmother putting this huge Thanksgiving turkey on a table surrounded by members of family. Freedom from fear, a mother and a father tucking their children into bed. The father holds a newspaper and is reading glasses. The only words you can read on the newspaper are horror and bomb. But that's it. It's how do you protect your children and Freedom to Worship. That painting showed profiles of a number of different people, each one of whom held some sort of an emblem of faith or wore some sort of piece of clothing that indicated what their faith was. This was Rockwell's idea, and it turned out to be brilliant. The paintings went on tour of the country for 12 months as part of a war bond drive. People came and saw the show, and they bought war bonds. These pictures in this show raised more than $130 million for the war effort.
So powerful was Rockwell's image of freedom from fear that Steven Spielberg recreated the scene for his Empire of the Sun movie half a century later.
December 7th, 1941.
Those which will live.
The film director Frank Capra had a similar appeal to the subliminal desires of average Americans. Like Rockwell's paintings, his films were often dismissed and dubbed Capricorn. But nevertheless, the two artists became a powerful wartime sales team.
Frank Capra was one of the most popular and probably one of the most famous movie directors of the 1930s. He made some light films, but a number of the films that he made dealt with ordinary people who are somehow thrown into an extraordinary circumstance. And the opportunity that they face, or the difficulty that they face, gives them the opportunity to sort of pull out the strongest portions of their personality.
Americans fighting. Fighting for their country while half a world away from it. Fighting for their country and for more than their country. Fighting for an idea. The idea bigger than the country. Without the idea, the country might have remained only a wilderness. Without the country, the idea might have remained only a dream.
That kind of story resonated very much with the kind of figures that Rockwell used in his pictures. So there are a lot of parallels. It was very much a theme in the 1930s in Rockwell's work, and it carried in Rockwell through to the 40s and even beyond.
Rockwell's images are familiar and enduring. But does his America exist anymore, if indeed it ever did? And what will a modern audience make of the myths and narratives that have inspired some of Hollywood's greatest filmmakers? Virginia Mecklenburg again.
Well, I'm hoping that people who come to see the show, well, first of all, will laugh. A lot of the pictures are really very funny. The pictures are also kind. I'm hoping they will feel like they see something that reminds them of some tidbit of meaning that they've experienced in their own lives. And I think they will, whether it's a picture of a little boy reading a book and imagining himself as a knight in shining armor, or whether it's a picture of a child growing up that will resonate with parents everywhere.